Patipano Bhagavato Savaka Sangho Sanghang Namami Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sama Sambuddhasa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Sammasambuddhassa Itipiso Bhagava Arahang Sama Sambuddho Vijacharana Sampanno Sugato Lokavidu Anuttaro Purisadhammasarati Satade Vamanusana Buddho Bhagava Tamahang Bhagavantang Abhipujayami Tamahang Bhagavantang Sirasanamami Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Sanditiko Akaliko Ehipasiko Opanayiko Pachatang Veditabo Vinyuhi Tamahang Dhammang Abhipujayami Tamahang Dhammang sevasanamami supatipanno bhagavato savakasangho uccupatipanno bhagavato savakasangho yaya patipanno bhagavato savakasangho samici patipanno bhagavato savakasangho yatitam chatari purisayugani atta purisapugala esa bhagavato savakasangho ahuneyo pahuneyo dakineyo anjali karaniyo anutaram punyaketam lokasa tamaham sangham api pujayami tamaham sangham sirasanamami. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, not busy with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world. entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, freed from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to false use, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good. Let's see how many questions we can get done today. But please, if I could ask you, make sure you don't ask more than one question a day, because otherwise, and if you have a question, you think of a better question later on in the afternoon, you can always take your old question out. Could you please suggest, recommend some livelihoods that are supportive of a life of meditation and service for a householder? Yeah, it's actually be Anagarika. Be a monk. Now you have to find out what does the least harm in your life. I'm considering something that involves simple tasks, minimal idle chatter, preferably quiet. So far I've come up with disability care worker, park ranger, gardener, librarian. It depends what you can actually do, because sometimes it's very hard to get a job. You have to make compromises. That's one of the reasons why, you know, we try our very best, you know, as to get the Sangha together so that we can just have very good lifestyles. So it's a difficult thing to do. But you know, whatever is the least harming, one thing to do is to make sure that you don't have big properties to look after, because that's a lot of work. In other words, I really like the idea of being in some people's apartments. The apartments are simple to look after. You don't have a garden. And it's, you know, just a small place. And sometimes, especially in cities, the apartments are really quiet. You've got some really good double-glazed windows, small apartment, and sometimes that's all you need. And live as simply as you possibly can. And sometimes you don't need to eat that much, and you can give away all of your TVs and computers and stuff. So you just have a very simple room, just maybe, just like when you were a student. Sometimes as a student, it's amazing, just one small room, that's all you needed. And you could live very happily. But these days we've got these huge houses. Because they have huge houses, they have huge things to look after. If you want to have a garden, just go to the park close by. If you want to have a swimming pool, then just go to the ocean and swim in there if you want, or public baths. If you want to do walking, then just get one of these little machines where you sit on there and you stand on there and you walk, so you don't have to have a long place. I often said that for the monks and the nuns. I mean, we have these walking meditation paths. They cost a lot of money to build. Why can't you have just a little machine with a conveyor belt on it and you walk? Even better than that, to make it environmentally friendly. Because they used to have this in the old days. They used to have these wheels. And if you wanted to go for a walk, you just walk on the wheel, and the wheel turns around, it runs a little motor, a generator, and that actually creates electricity.
It's environmentally friendly. Maybe. They used to use that for torturing people in the old days. Anyway, how do I know if I'm making the right investment decision? How to not to lose money in the stock market? You will always lose stock market money. Lose it in the good karma market. Invest in monasteries and retreat centres. But it's also that just all the investment in this, investment in that. Because somebody once told me this, you invest in a bank. Because our Buddhist society, you know, we were just put under pressure, make sure that what you're investing in is like ethical and moral. So we decided, let's try to go for, I think, Bendigo Bank. It's got a branch in Byford. They said, you know who Bendigo Bank is owned by? It's owned by this person and that person, this company, and they're all just interrelated. So, you know, it's just whatever you do seems to be a little bit unethical. So you try your very best to do what you can. And especially, you know, sometimes investing in like monasteries, this creates good karma. It is honestly the best to do. So forget about the stock market. The stock market will just go pear-shaped. Look at me. I've gone pear-shaped. So that's the best to do. You mentioned the two ladies who were very thankful to you for helping them through the depression they had after divorce. Can you please talk specifically about what had helped them, or in fact what would help anyone letting go of a person, whether because of a divorce or death, and what ways would help to overcome the grief? Please remember, this is natural. Nothing does last. Eventually we have to get used to the fact that everything which is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated from me. That's a truth which, you know, no one can deny. And then you say, well, how can I overcome grief? It's grief which you never prepared yourself to begin with. Okay, they have the old simile. Suppose this was a very expensive cup. No, it's only just a cup, I don't know where this came from. But you know, sometimes, because I touched it and I drank it, sometimes you auction it on my birthday for a lot of money. What are they doing that for? You know, we're always trying to get new things to auction on my birthday to help out, raise funds for all sorts of stuff. And the last thing which I suggested, on my 70th birthday, we're raising funds for the retreat centre over in Melbourne, and I said, why don't you auction my toilet seat? I've been sitting on that for about 30 years. And I've got very good digestion. So what that means is, that is just, if any of you have difficulty with, you know, too much diarrhea or constipation or whatever else like that, you just auction my toilet seat, you sit on that. Wow, that is blessed. Of course it is, same as everything else. But they said no. It's demeaning. Anyway, with the cup, is if this was really expensive, then Ajahn Chah would always say, can you see the crack in it? It's a wonderful teaching. Because, you know, you've looked at it and I can't see any crack in it at all. It says the crack of impermanence, of fragility, the crack in each one of you, that one day you're going to fall apart and die. Me too, everybody here. The crack in jhana growth. You know, sometimes you can look in some of your hearts, see a little bit of a crack here, a crack there happening. It's a crack of fragility. It's always there. And because you know it's cracked, that is why you care for it. Because you know how fragile. It reminds you it's temporary. And that's why you have to care for it as much as you can to make sure it lasts as long as possible. If it was plastic, unbreakable, permanent, lasting forever, you wouldn't need to look after it. Same with your body, and the body of your friends, and the loved ones. They're cracked. Next time you see your mum, say, Mum, you're cracked. you might not understand. So maybe don't do that. But instead, when you look at yourself, you know, and your friends, you say that you're not always going to be like this, you're not always going to be together. So whatever time you have together, care for it. You always remember, whatever is mine, beloved and pleasing, will one day become separated. So when it does become separated from you, there's never any surprise. You get the telephone call or the email, yeah, I expected that. Can you say that? When maybe, you know, a son passes away, a daughter dies, and say, why are they dying so young? Because death doesn't choose a particular age. It's one of those stories in the opening door of your heart, which I put in there. And it was the story of the told to me by this old monk who lived in a simple hut in a forest in north of Thailand. And he said, one is only a thatch and bamboo hut, very, very simple. And he said one evening there was a big storm in the forest. And after the storm, he stayed up all night because it was dangerous. Many trees came crashing to the forest floor. He survived, that's why he could tell this story. And then in the morning he went outside to look at the damage. And he was lucky, many trees had just missed his hut. But what took his attention was the leaves, which had been torn off the tree by the storm. Most of the leaves on the forest floor were the old brown leaves, leaves which had lived their life fully on the tree. And there were some which were yellow leaves, some green leaves, and some really young green leaves, which were probably only shot forth the day before. They too had been torn off and lay dead on the forest floor. And even though young green leaves had been torn off, there were still these old brown leaves, curled up, really old. They were still clinging on to the tree of life, even though young green leaves had been torn off. Had something gone wrong? Or is this just nature? Nature sometimes goes through our communities. They take mostly, you know, the elderly, you know, the 70-year-olds and the 80-year-olds. How old am I? But sometimes it takes the young ones as well, the 69 and 68-year-olds. That's not young. But anyway, this is just the nature of our life. So we never know when death is going to come. We do know it's going to come. So we make the best use of our time. We care for our life. And then if you care the very best you can to your life, then what regrets have you got? You did the best you could. Well done. This morning you talked about the first hindrances, wanting in the five senses. What about wanting in the sixth sense, like thinking in the mind? A lot of the thinking in the mind is not to do with the sixth sense. That's why they call it karma vitakka. It's like thinking about the five senses. And if you have to look about all the thoughts you have, most of those thoughts are connected to the realm of the five senses. Most of the reason why is because you don't know that world of the sixth sense. Many people even deny that realm of the sixth sense exists. That's one of the reasons when we meditate, when we start to touch that realm of the sixth sense, the mind, and get to understand it, one of the first things which is so obvious to you, if you get into something like a jhana, or even nimitta stage, it should be obvious, that you're not really going to be afraid of death anymore. Afraid of dying, yes, because dying can be very painful and uncomfortable, but the moment of death itself, you're free from the five senses and the body. And you know what happens that when you die? What happens in that death moment? You see the light. Have you heard that before? Nimitta. That's what happens when you meditate. The five senses get very, very subdued, and sometimes they just almost disappear, and you see this beautiful light in the mind, the nimitta. That's pretty much what you see when you go through your dying process, or just after death. So each one of you will see a nimitta sooner or later. But if you see it when you're healthy and alive, and you get to understand it, you understand what death is. And there's nothing to be afraid of in death. It's one of the benefits of doing this meditation. The mystery of death, the fear, and we're always afraid of things we don't understand. And it's not just understanding by belief, it's experience. You understand, you experience what anicca is and how it works. You've got nothing to be afraid of. It's incredibly pleasant, just like death. And that little story, which I wish I could find this again somewhere, but the story was BBC did a program about near-death experiences. And the one which I really, really remembered, because it was funny, and I just like humour. And this was a real experience of this English lady. And she had been in hospital, out of hospital, many, many times. You know, she was always sick, it seemed. But anyway, she had an operation, and she died on the operating table and floated out of her body. And then, you know, she felt so wonderful. At last, she was free of this really burdensome body. And when she was free of that body, she met this spirit. This is how she described it. Who said to her, "It's not your time, you have to go back." Many of you who have read those experiences of near-death experiences, that happens quite often, to meet somebody say, "You've got to go back." No, but you know, she was a very independent woman. She said, "No, I'm not going back." And the spirit said, "But you have to." "No way! But you must." "I'm not going back to the old body. I've suffered that too long already. I'm not going." "But you must." "But I'm not." "You have to." "No way." And they had an argument on the psychic plane, whatever that is. And eventually it was settled. Obviously it had to be settled this way because she could tell the story. This spirit got hold of her and threw her back in her body, whether she liked it or not. And so, you know, she came to again afterwards. And on the interview, when she described that on TV, on BBC, then I always remember her face really screwing up and said, "When I die next time, when I really die, the first thing I'm going to do, I'm going to find that spirit. And when I do, I've been planning and thinking, all this revenge. What he did to me is unforgivable." I know that's quite amusing. The other funny story, which I'm into this now, of near-death experiences. And you can check this out with Venerable Nibbuta over there. He's the monk who was from the Punjab. And when he was young, one of the elderly women in this community died in the morning time. Doctors checked, yeah, she was dead. And the thing was in that part of India, that all of the men have the surname Singh and all of the women have the surname Kaur. So it's Mrs. Kaur, Mrs. Jenny Kaur. I know I don't have Jenny as an Indian name, but anyway, Jenny Kaur, Susan Kaur, whatever. So because they all have the same surname, it's not that unlikely that every now and again you have two women with the same name. So what actually happened was, when this woman died, they checked her out, she was dead. So they had to arrange the funeral service, and they were going to do it that evening to cremate her. And so they had all the wood ready and all the people ready, and they were going to do the ceremony, and then she woke up. She came back. She was alive. That really shocked the doctors. I mean, this is not sort of remote or 100 years ago. It's amazing that she was alive now. But then she told her story, what happened. She said that, you know, that as soon as she died, she left her body and she went with these two spirits to this big place. And then the head spirit there, this is how she described it, the head spirit really told off the two lower spirits, "So you've got the wrong Mrs. Kaur." Mistakes do happen. So they had to take her back. So you ask Venerable Buddha, this is what happened. And they took her back, so that's when she came to. And a few minutes later, another Mrs. Kaur, the same surname, the same first name, she died. She never came back. This time they got the right Mrs. Kaur. So that's why I'm always a little bit concerned, you know, this Ajahn Bhumali, Ajahn Brahm. So if I happen to die, you know, I might come back again and say, oh, I've got the wrong Brahm. It should be Bhumali. Or whatever, anyway. So a lot of time people don't understand what that sixth sense is, what the mind is. And that's one of the reasons why I love talking about, you know, getting into jhanas or nimittas and understanding that sixth sense. Because that really starts to explain so much about life. You get insights into rebirth. You know, and people who think this is your only life, and that's ridiculous, that's nonsense. You know, you have many lives. I don't know. Sometimes I really wonder why it is people have this strong view there is not more lives than just this one. And it's that rejection. Why do people just reject that idea? At least, at the very least, they should say, I don't know, because there's lots of evidence for it. Really scientific evidence. It's basically proven. Why do people reject it? And that's what's really fascinating to me. I think it's really fear. Why they sort of somehow reject it in a very illogical way. Fear bends the truth to fit them. In other words, they're afraid that they will be reborn again. It has lots of consequences. And actually accepting those consequences of rebirth is just too hard for people. So they say, no, it can't exist. But don't worry, because if they don't believe in rebirth or reincarnation in this life, they will in their next. Reincarnation is making a comeback. Oh, thank you that somebody's laughing. Okay, I better carry on with these things. Dear Ajahn, please help me know more about the purpose of the teddy bears, Winnie the Pooh, green toy. That's not a joke. Those teddy bears are really important. Because sometimes when people do meditation, sometimes it's difficult. Why? Because the thing which is really missing is the kindness, the softness, the joy, the happiness, the feeling of safety. And putting a teddy bear in your lap while you meditate, you try it. It just adds that missing ingredient of softness, kindness and joy, metta. Which means that once that is added, your meditation goes so much more deep and peaceful. The first person who did this was this gentleman in Hong Kong. He brought two teddy bears to the retreat. He was a young man. And then when I saw, why do you bring them? And he said, because, you know, they helped me get deeper meditation. Yeah, well done. And so that I asked him, there's two ones there, can you please allow other people on this retreat just to borrow them, just for a day? And they did. At the end of the day, they offered him so much money to buy those teddy bears. He said, no, they're mine. And they did that because they saw the value in them. Not as sort of, you know, you can get them from a supermarket or somewhere, or a toy shop. They saw the value of them, that these were incredibly powerful help to meditation. And so when I saw that, that was many years ago, we made sure we got a few teddy bears here. And ever since, they've grown and grown and grown and grown. They can't be keeping 8 precepts. Because we only start with 1 or 2, and people take them home, but there always come every time. But because we had teddy bears, then we had got all sorts of other stuff, like, you know, there's domes or sheep or dogs or goodness knows what else, or the green alien thing over there. I don't know what those are. But I like the teddy bears because, you know, I can relate to those. You know, you just hug it. It's very soft. It's very welcoming. It doesn't challenge you at all. And it makes, you know, the meditation so much easier. And as many people, and you'll do this, you say, can I take the teddy bear home with me? If you care for it, yes. And sometimes people just, they donate more teddy bears. They're very cheap, they're very easy to find. And after a while, that helps you with getting a deeper meditation. And of course, you know, that have a sense of humor and puns. This is where we get the term bear awareness from. B-E-A-R, awareness. Bear awareness, because it gives you that kindness with the meditation. If you don't believe me, just try it. Dear Ajahn, would you please talk about the similes the Buddha used for the five hindrances? Coloured water, muddy water, agitated water, etc. Yeah, it's sometimes that when you put like beautiful coloured dye in the water, it looks beautiful, but you can't see what's really in it. That's like the simile for sensory desire. Makes the water look good, but you can't actually see through it. It's not clear anymore. The agitated water, that's for hatred. It's all just wavy. And it's almost like boiling water. And of course you can't sort of see it. You can't see a clear reflection of it either. And that's the agitated water. They have water with, if I get this right, water with algae on the top. That's sloth and torpor. It's just like your brain is getting covered with moss and algae. You have, what's the other one? Muddy water. That can be, sloth and torpor. Even doubt, you can't see through it. And restlessness, it's also agitated water, isn't it? Boiling water. One is agitated water, one is boiling water. So you can make your own similes up at all, if you wish. But the best thing is very still water, still and clear, and then you can see to the bottom of it. After death, how is it decided which realm we are going to be reborn in, and who decides? That's a good question, because again, I really reacted when you see so-called heavenly beings tell you you've got to go to a hell realm because you've done terrible things. And I thought, that can't be right. You're a heavenly being. If I was a heavenly being born in that realm, if I was the Yama god, and someone say, like, you know, Pol Pot, oh yeah, Pol Pot. Say Pol Pot came up, and I had to decide where he would go. What would I do? I'd look at him and say, well, actually, I started this ceremony not with Pol Pot, with Adolf Hitler. I'd look at him and say, Adolf Hitler, you've done some terrible, terrible things. But Adolf Hitler, I forgive you. You're a heavenly being, you're wise, you give this beautiful kindness. And that beautiful kindness will take away all that ill will from an Adolf Hitler. And I say, okay, I'm going to put you in the heaven realm. But before I do that, I'm going to shave off that moustache, change your hairstyle, give you a new suit of clothes, because some people don't understand the power of forgiveness and love. And they will think, what on earth is Yama the god, you know, doing, letting Adolf Hitler go into heaven? People might not understand that. But a heavenly being should have enough kindness and love that any agitated being can just feel that kindness and love and realize that what you've done is wrong and also receive that forgiveness. The only exception to that would be when someone refuses to accept forgiveness and they have what we call guilt. And that guilt, that idea of self-punishment, it doesn't matter who forgives you, you have to forgive yourself. That's the only person who can really forgive. And the job of other people like myself, is just to encourage you. So it's okay to forgive, to let go. And that means the only person who sends you to lower realms is yourself. The only person who frees you from lower realms is yourself. That's one of the reasons why the doors of hell are always open. You can walk out whenever you feel you don't need to be punished, and that punishment, that pain doesn't help at all. You send yourself to those realms, as you can send yourself to heaven realms. Why do you want to go to a heaven realm? One of the best realms is this human realm. And the reason is because in this human realm we have a pretty, for most people, a pretty good balance of suffering and happiness. Enough suffering in our lives to encourage us to learn and to live a more simple life, a more peaceful life, a more kind life. It's just, you know, the right degree of pain and happiness that we can learn and grow. Too much pain and we can't learn. Too much happiness and we get lazy. So it's just about the right balance. But you know, sometimes when you go to some realms, it's amazing what people can get attached to. One of my favorite stories, and the Indonesians love this story, and that was the worm in the pile of dung story. And the reason it's a funny story, but it is just so easy if you understand what you get up to in your life. The once there were these two monks, and these two monks were the best friends. And after they'd died, one got reborn in the heaven realm, the very high heavenly being. The other got reborn as a worm in a pile of cow dung. And the one who got reborn in the heaven realm was enjoying himself up there for a while. And he thought, where's my friend gone? Because when you're friends, you know, you don't let your friend down. You always want to go and visit them, find out what they're up to, what they're doing. And so he scanned all the heaven realms, couldn't find any trace of his friend there. So then started to scan the human realm. Couldn't find his friend there either. And started to scan the animal realm. No sign of his friend there at all. So I thought, you know, just to check out maybe. Scanned the realm of the creepy crawlies. And then found his best friend had been reborn as a worm in a pile of cow poo. And he thought, my goodness, what did he do to get reborn down there? That's not a very nice life. And he thought, I'm going to help him. So he went down in front of that big pile of cow poo. And it was a heavenly being. Imagine if that was, you know, it's like the Queen of England. Cow poo, oh. And she's, you think, too refined to even get close to cow poo. But then this is much higher than that. It's a heavenly being. And so went, but because his friendship and loving kindness was so strong, he called out to his friend, hey, worm, worm. And this little worm poked his head out of the cow poo. Yeah, what do you want? Said, in our previous life, we were best friends. We were both monks together. I don't know why, what karma it was, but you've been reborn in this stinky, smelly, dirty pile of cow poo. As for me, I've been reborn up in the heaven realms. And it's so beautiful up there. I can take you. Come with me. It's a much better life than in cow poo. Wait for a moment, said the worm. In heaven, is there any cow poo? He said, no, of course not. There's no cow poo, then I'm not going. The cow poo, that's my home. It's fragrant. It's warm. It's my food. It's delicious. Because for a worm who lives in cow poo, they're attached to it. And so the heavenly being put his fingers in there, tried to pull the worm out. he could show him what heaven was like. Then maybe he might know better and come with him, live up in heaven. But every time he tried to pull the worm out of the pile of poo, the worm was all slimy on its outside and didn't want to go, and sort of wriggled and writhed and eventually escaped and went deeper into the cow poo. The worm kept on trying to pull him out. Leave me alone, I'm being worm-napped. No, I'm trying to help you, said the heavenly being. And he got his hands really dirty trying to get the worm out of the pile of cow shit. And I say what it deserves to be. And eventually, after trying so many times, the heavenly being had to give up and let his best friend live in the cow shit, because he was attached to it. He liked it. And that's the story that so many times your monks and nuns, they teach you. They try and pull you out of your cow shit. Come on, keep the precepts. Live more simply. Just, you know, just ordain if we can get a place for you. What do you do? No. I'm attached to my cricket. I remember that for the Sri Lankans. I just gave a talk once in Adelaide years ago. Hardly anyone came. And I realised there was a one-day international between Sri Lanka and Australia. I didn't have a chance. They all went to watch the cricket, not the Dhamma. You try to pull them out, no way. I don't know what you're attached to, but it's very hard sometimes to pull people away from the cow poo. You say it's stinky, it's smelly, it's not going to get you anywhere. There's much better stuff than that. No, I like my cow poo. And that's why the worm in Indonesian Bahasa is Cacing. And they call me Guru Cacing. I've been trying for years to get all those Ahipasico Foundation members to get out of the cow poo. And they don't want to go. Anyway, so it's you decide where you want to go. But how can you make that decision? It's so conditioned. What you like to eat, where you like to live, and how you like to behave. That's one of my jobs, is to recondition you, otherwise known as brainwashing. Out of kindness. Dear Vedamajan, do five hindrances manifest as thoughts? Are they five hindrances source of thoughts in meditation? Thank you, Ajahn, for the great retreat. The five hindrances aren't thoughts, but they create thoughts about the five hindrances. They're just ways where the mind just gets distorted, cognitive distortion. You don't see what you want. Look, today I told you that I went out today because I'd promised somebody to actually to go and bless a wedding. Now those, the two couples, I blessed the wedding today. And I looked at them and they were so in love. He was, don't need to read his mind, she is the most beautiful girl in the world. And he is the most wonderful guy today. In a couple of years' time, why did I marry him? I must have been crazy. Why am I stuck with her? Maybe not a couple of years, but maybe a few, you know, either earlier or later. Many of you have been married a long time. Can you look at your wife and say, oh, she's such a beautiful lady. And she's almost 70. Can you look at your husband and say, oh, I'm so fortunate to have married him. He's wonderful. Honestly. But when you first fall in love, that's what you do. You see what you want to see. That's why I never said this today, because there was this other lady over in Singapore. She told me, that was in the ABC, that Ang Beng Chu, she said that when she got married, her father took aside her husband and told him some advice. "You probably love my daughter very much." "Oh yes, she's so beautiful, so charming. Even the way she picks her nose is delightful." I made that up. And the son-in-law's father-in-law said, "Yes, that's what it's like when you first get married. But after 1 or 2 years, you start to see the faults and defects in my daughter. When you start to see her faults and defects, please remember this. If she hadn't got those faults and defects to begin with, she'd have married someone much better than you." And the truth in that was this. Anyway, the five hindrances, they distort your thinking, distort your perceptions, distort your wisdom. And they're not the source of thoughts in meditation, but they can be. Main thoughts in meditation are just sometimes our bad habits. You know, we think that the only way we can know truth is by thinking about it, which means that many of the wise people in the world are called the great thinkers. Great thinkers aren't wise. People who are still, peaceful, they're the ones who have the greatest wisdom. Already mentioned, someone like Roger Penrose, Nobel Prize winner, Sir, thought about black holes. Brilliant. And many other things as well. He's a great thinker, but he's not wise. You get an Ajahn Chah, he didn't think very much, but his wisdom would just blew my mind away. Only had 4 years of schooling. Could the nuns please share their favorite teaching from Buddhism? Something they would love to share with us. That's a teaching on silence. They're sharing silence with you. Okay, I'm sure later on you can ask them that. Maybe tomorrow? Still the same silence. Okay. They always say everyone's here for a life purpose, to learn something, give, etc. Is it true? Are we here based on karma? It's a life purpose, I think, is a good way of looking. You can't say one is true, the other is false, or both are true, or both are false. It's a good way of looking at things, a life purpose, to learn something. So what are you learning which is going to stay with you? All you learn about knowledge disappears. You forget about things. But all you learn about the emotional intelligence, that is something which is going to stay much more longer with you. In other words, go into future lives. And it's those tendencies and characteristics, or the particular knowledge you have, those are the things where we can learn. The little things, you know, what's the most important thing in life? You know, who is the best, the male or the female? The mind, you know, the process which gets reborn, is neither. So the mind doesn't have gender. Body does. Which is the best race? All that sort of ridiculous stuff, when you understand the nature of the sixth sense, doesn't make much sense at all. Some are more privileged than others. But you're not stuck with this particular gender or this particular race. That's one of the reasons why I love the idea of rebirth. And to know that Donald Trump will be reborn as probably a gay Syrian. Thank you for laughing. I don't know. But if you were going to be reborn, imagine that politicians knew that they were going to be reborn. They're the ones who's... For most politicians, they make these important decisions about, you know, the health of the environment of this planet, thinking that they're not going to come back to reap the consequences. If they knew they're going to get reborn again, and sometimes in some of the lands where they destroyed those lands, they'll make it a very different decision-making for them. And it personally, they're going to get the karmic results of their actions. They'll be much, much, much more sensitive to the health and sustainability of this planet. When they think, oh, they're going to just die and that's the end of it, then they can just try and squeeze as much personal power and pleasure as they want, when they know they have to come back, then they'd be much more responsible. They always say, oh, that's the purpose. The purpose here is to learn wisdom, emotional wisdom, so it can be more sensitive and more understanding. What is the purpose of life? Same question. And I remember this, one of the answers I gave, the purpose of life is to find out what the purpose of life is. You can't argue with that, can you? The other adaptation of that is the purpose of life is whatever purpose you give to your life. It's not fixed. What purpose do you give to your life? That's the purpose of the life. Dear Ajahn, I feel a general sense of well-being in both body and mind, but... I'm going to stop there. Here we go. But it feels a bit flat. Wonderful. The opposite of flat is like sharp and spiky, isn't it? What do you want to feel? Anyway, the joy and energy are missing. You're not listening to my jokes, are you? See, that's better. Okay, anyway, all the usual tricks, tea, naps, walks, bad jokes. You know, it's interesting that when a person is negative, all jokes are bad. All sunsets, I've seen that before. You know, just the best food. Blech. That's called depression. So sometimes allow happiness and look for beauty. It's all there. It's an amazing amount of beauty there. Don't look for the faults in life or the faults in yourself. Is my peace or meter broken? Help, what to do? Am I being too greedy for peace? That's more like it. You probably are too greedy for peace. And just be kind to yourself. Accept yourself for who you are. Be content and easily satisfied, not proud and demanding in nature. Sometimes what happens, you come on these retreats and your friends say, wow, you got on the retreat, a 9-day retreat. And when you go back, they say, how did you go? And it's very, very embarrassing. It's so terrible. I went on one of these 9-day retreats and I'm just more irritated than when I started. This is not trying to achieve something or get rid of things. It's learning how to relax and be peaceful. That's easy to do. But if you set yourself goals, aspirations lead to desperations, which lead to expirations. Then don't aspire to anything. Just learn the beauty of what is here right now. People say, you're crazy, Ajahn Brahm. You don't know my mind. Of course I know your mind. And it's beautiful enough. But sometimes we can't see it. That's that story which I've said so many times about the trees in the forest. While you're here, you'll go for walks in the forest. Where is your favourite tree? And when you find your favourite tree, the one you like the most, it will never be perfect. It will be bent, twisted and damaged. And that's why it's all twisted and bent and branches hanging off and holes in the trunk. That's what makes it beautiful. And then you learn a lot of Dhamma from that. You are the same. You're all damaged goods. You're all bent, you've been traumatized by something in your life. Worked very hard, had a difficult time. You're imperfect in that sense. You're also beautiful. So you look at yourself and your life, and then you can smile at it. It becomes your favorite tree. The one which is twisted, bent and damaged. When you look at life, you don't want to improve it. You don't want to change it. You want to be kind to it. Then you enjoy it. So that's the problem with so-called, you know, spiritual improvement. Do you really need to improve? You're a tree in the forest, you belong. Be at peace with yourself. Be kind to yourself. And when you do, you start to appreciate this body of mind in which you live. And after a while, if, you know, for some reason, because you have a big heart and lots of loving kindness, you get fat, what's wrong with being fat? You know, two of my, you know, we always have mentors, people we look up to. And this was before I met Ajahn Chah. Ajahn Chah was fat and happy, so was my preceptor. There was these two other people I always looked up to before I knew Buddhism. And they were both fat and happy. I didn't know why that was the case. And the reason was, you never see any fat, miserable people. There's a reason for that. Because if you are fat, you get lots of gunk flowing through your blood. And if you are happy, this has been proven by medicine, if you're happy and laugh a lot, your arteries expand. All your blood vessels expand if you're happy. And because they expand, they're very, very wide, which means all that gut can flow through without clogging anything up. It's like a super highway, many lanes wide. If you only have like a single lane road, there's obviously traffic jams in there. So if you are a very happy person, then you've got such wide blood vessels that nothing clogs. So you can eat as much greasy stuff as you like fish and chips, and you don't ever get any problems. That's why if you are sort of happy and laugh a lot, then you never get a heart attack. But if you eat sort of greasy food and you're miserable and negative, you're going to die young. And that explained to me two people. One was this TV show which I watched when I was a kid called Robin Hood. And the religious figure there was this fellow called Friar Tuck. If you remember Friar Tuck. He was always really kind and very happy. He would now help Robin Hood defeat the Sheriff of Nottingham, who was a bad guy. And he was also fat. But the other one, he was a really exceptional person. And this person, he was always fat, and he's admired throughout the whole world. And he's so kind and so generous. And he's lived such a long time. He's still alive today. I saw him in the shopping centres a few months ago. What's his name? Santa Claus, yeah. Look at Santa Claus. He's very happy, ho, ho, ho. And very generous, always ready to give, you know, to whoever asks for things. And he's how old is he? So he's my religious mentor and icon. Santa Claus and Freitag. Well, whatever about that, you do know that is true if you're happy and you laugh a lot and you're easy to laugh and see the beauty in things, then your blood vessels do expand. Next question, Ajahn Brahm. I am afraid of ghosts, particularly when alone and at night. I think that's quite understandable. I always wondered, what do ghosts do during the day? And I remember just as a young man thinking about that, and like, these are they sleep during the day, or where do they go during the daytime? Do they just come out at night time? And how do they get around? Because sometimes the nights are really dark. I can't find out which way I'm going. And how do I've never seen the ghosts with flashlights. And why do ghosts get married? Do they have little baby ghosts? Or do they have a job? Or what do? Do they have to sort of get a passport or something when they go into the ghost realm? And do they go to jail if they're really naughty? What do ghosts do? So I actually, as a young man, I really was looking for ghosts because I wanted to find a ghost and interview them. You know, they have in-depth interview with like politicians and with cricket players and other people, but no one yet has done an in-depth interview with a ghost, a real one. What do they do? How long do they live? What do they do? What do they eat? Do they like sort of fish and chips, or do they like vegetarian? Are they vegans? So I was really interested in finding a ghost. So look, don't be afraid of them. Just the next time you find one, send them to me and I'll do the interview. Take a photograph of me and the ghost. But anyway, but I am afraid of ghosts in Jhana Grove, the most compassionate place on earth. My worry is good spirits are going to haunt me for all the bad things I did in the past. How to deal with these fears? Look, this place is protected. Ghosts can't come close to good people. And I know this because if you just look at the hierarchy of different realms of existence, you've got the human realm. Below the human realm is the animal realm. Below the animal realm is the ghost realm. We're two realms higher. We've got more power than the ghosts have. And if you realize this, how true that is, if you ever saw a ghost and you didn't want to see them, you just tell them, no, out. They have to go. There was one of the monks in the old days, and he's now a lay person. He actually lives, I don't mind saying this, he's one of the big supporters of Ajahn Santuti. But when he was a monk, he went to one of these monasteries in the northeast of Thailand, which was famous for its ghosts. He was meditating there one day, and he was meditating all day, a hot day, he got a bit tired, and so he leant against the wall, put his feet out, and then he felt something just hit his leg and put him on the foot. And he thought it was some heavenly being because he was being lazy. So he said, thank you, crossed his legs and carried on meditating. And later on, it came in again. But this time, as it came in more and more, it came with this bad smell. And he realized it wasn't a heavenly being, it was one of the ghosts playing around with him. And so how he solved the problem, he was sitting there one afternoon, he could smell the ghost coming in. And he wasn't a crazy person, he was a very smart man. And he told the ghost, you can sit meditation in here whenever you want, but if you mess around, get out! He scolded the ghost, and the ghost never came back again. exert your power. Tell the ghost, and the ghost has to go. My personal story? I don't mind saying this one. When I was... You don't need to be afraid, because you're safe here. When I was in Thailand, and on my walking, I tried to make sure that on the moon days, I was at a monastery so I could do the Patimokkha chanting. It's one of our rules for monks. So I went to this monastery, and it was Tamsi Gao in Phupan. It was Ajahn Suwat was the head monk there. A very good monk, one of the disciples of Ajahn Mun. So I stayed there for a couple of days for the Patimokkha ceremony. And after that was finished, I told him I made a resolution from Ubon to walk all the way to Ajahn Ben's monastery in Sakonikon, or just past Sakonikon. So, it was a 2-day walk, about 60 kilometers. And so, through the mountains. And so I asked him, is there a nice place to stay halfway? And I like staying in caves. Is there a cave there? And this was one of the senior monks, I trust him 100%. He said, yes, there's a cave about halfway, very convenient for you. But, he said, there's a ghost in that cave. And that ghost, has teased many monks, and a few monks have actually gone a bit crazy in there because of the ghost. And he said, can you handle that? I said, yes, I'm going to go for it. So, when you hear that there's a ghost who likes to tease the monks in a particular cave, and you hear that from a very senior monk, I thought, yes, there's going to be a ghost here. So I managed to walk to that cave. It was about halfway. And checked in at the village beforehand to find out where that cave was. And so they could also prepare any alms food for me in the morning, if I survived. That's only a joke. So they took me to this beautiful old cave. And this was really a remote place in times before. And it had a very old Buddha statue in there. It was in a very beautiful place and had a spring coming out of the ground outside where I could wash. And it was such good water, you could drink it as well. So there was everything there for me. But I did notice that the layperson who took me there, as soon as it started to get dark, he said, I have to go now. Because he was afraid of the ghost. So I was in this dark cave by myself. And I was waiting for the ghost. I really wanted to see it. So I was meditating. I'd been up and walking all day, 30-kilometer walk. So not so long, all day, not fast, just taking my time. But then, and I was young and fit. So then I was sitting there waiting for the ghost. And they did actually say that deeper in the cave there was an old skeleton of a human being. So then that must be, where the ghost come from. But anyway, I didn't have a chance to explore the cave. It was too dark and I just wanted to meditate. So I was meditating and meditating and meditating, waiting and waiting and waiting. And waiting. And waiting. I forget what time it was, but I'd meditated for a few hours and thought, okay, this is enough. So I lay down to go to sleep. And I didn't go to sleep yet. As soon as my head hit the pillow, boom! It was a sound, it's not dark, the sound of something running. And it stopped right in front of me. It was a ghost. And as soon as it stopped right in front of me, my reaction was, I've been waiting for you for hours and now you decide to come, get out of here. And I chased the ghost away. He says it was not being respectful enough to me. That's what I thought. And so I noticed. Fell asleep. And that was my experience of ghosts. And the ghosts, if they don't treat you properly, you chase them away. You think that was a good thing to do? Can you do that? Well, I knew that ghosts can never harm you. So because of that, you're not scared of them. So anyway, if any ghosts come, they can't come into this place. Because it's just too much good energy here. If any ghost ever does try and come in to where you're staying, here or elsewhere in the world, please remember you do have the power to chase them away. Exert that power. Say, no, go. They have no choice. All they can ever do is make you afraid. They can't do anything more than that. Oh my goodness, I'm not going to finish this. Ghost stories? No, I don't tell ghost stories, that's enough. As a kid, I always used to come bottom at school. Brilliant. I was bullied for my appearance, so that's not really good, and for my gender. When I became teenager, then I decided to work harder and prove them wrong. Did reasonably well at school and now average successful. I grew up very bad, low self-esteem. Even these days when people bullied or abuse, my old belief of low self-esteem comes back. Something to hold the crest of bodhisattva for too long. Okay, that's the idea, the last person in school gets a bodhisattva prize. Please advise how to be free. Thanks with mega gratitude and respect. Please know that there's so many amazing people in this world who came bottom of the class, who didn't graduate from university. I tell this to parents whose children are having a hard time passing the grade 12 exams here to go to university. And I say, how many people do you know who didn't go to university or failed university and became billionaires? Who are they? Steve Jobs was one. He crashed out of university. Bill Gates. Michael Dell. Sorry? Dick Smith. Albert Einstein. These amazing people. Brilliant. Sorry?
Tommy Guy from ING.
Ah, ING.
And the airplane.
Oh, Richard Branson, yeah. Branson, yeah. So there's so many people did incredibly well when they didn't pass their exams, and that's why I had to become a monk, because I couldn't make any money because I've finished university. So the point is, this is one of the reasons why he's a Buddhist, that Davidson. He was wondering why that people who do really well at university don't seem to make it in the world. And that's where he discovered the best prediction of, you know, how you're going to be successful in the world is this thing called emotional intelligence. And he realized that emotional intelligence was a far better a predictor of success in the world. And he was a Buddhist. And that's why that, please, if you grow in emotional, don't worry about what happens in school, emotional intelligence, where you can make friends, you can make friends with yourself, you have lots of forgiveness, lots of kindness, lots of ability to laugh. I always, you know, tell these young people that you see them just trying so hard to look attractive. The best makeup you can ever have is a good smile. That warms everybody's heart. And you're happy. So that's the best education. Learning how to be smart, how to be kind, how to forgive, and how to love. That is actually what we should be teaching our kids. Okay. Okay, so you hang around here long enough, and then people are jealous of you. What do you mean when you say be kind to the moment, the breath? Your breath, oh, my poor breath. I've been breathing for such a long time, for 70 years, and I feel gratitude to my breath. Thank you, breath. That's the style of being kind. However you want to breathe, breath. And sometimes I learn how to breathe backwards. To play with the breath. You know how to breathe backwards? People are already laughing. Where are we getting up? Like, yeah, it's getting late. How to breathe through backwards breath meditation. So now I'm going to ask you to close your eyes, breathe in and out three times. After the third out breath, open your eyes. Okay, go. Just three, that's enough. Some of the people can't count these days. I saw this joke someone sent to me. They said, this guy went to the bookshop and got a book on mathematics for dummies. It was $16.99 a copy. And so the bookseller charged him $50. Mathematics for dummies. One of the other jokes they said, which I thought was really funny, I'd never seen it before. You know on the Kentucky Fried Chicken, sort of the logo, you know, Colonel Sanders, I think it is. If you have a look, you know, you've got his head and you've got, it's basically like a tie which he was wearing. Look at the way the tie is. It isn't actually, another way of looking at it is seeing it as like a stick man. You've got two arms and two legs and the head on top. And once you see that once, you say, why did I see that for years? Anyway, what was I talking about? what? Oh, kind of breath, yeah. So that's the ordinary breath meditation. Now, close your eyes again. And this time, breathe out first and then breathe in. Out first, in, three times. Now to the third in-breath, open your eyes. That's called backwards breath meditation. Why do we always start with an in-breath? That's totally arbitrary. So why don't, when you do breath meditation next time, breathe out first. Breathe out a long breath. And then breathe in a long breath. Instead of in first and out first. That is just, it's discriminatory to the out breaths. We should treat all breaths equally. I call that backwards breath meditation. Makes it different. Okay, I'm getting tired now and this is getting silly, so. Can we leave these questions till tomorrow? Yeah. No? Yes? Yeah. Okay. Yeah, we'll be back tomorrow. More silly questions tomorrow. Anyway, we've only got a few questions here left, so we'll leave them till tomorrow. So thank you, everybody. What do we do now? We do the backwards sadhu meditation. Sadhu! 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 Okay. Good night. See you tomorrow. Oh boy. It's getting sillier and sillier.